welcome to another edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com. Hope you're surviving the snow. John Schmelk, Paul Dottino are hunkered down in our Big Blue Kickoff studios. We're doing okay. We got here safe. If you're on the roads, be careful, everybody. We know it's a little slick out there. So much for a half-an-inch coating. It looks like there's about 2 or 3 inches outside on the practice fields here at the Quest Diagnostics Training Center. Anyway, let me start the show, Paul, by kind of giving the same disclaimer that I gave at the start of yesterday's show. There's a lot of reports and word and news out there. People are assuming that Pat Shurmur is going to be the Giants' next head coach. Just a reminder, NFL rules and regulations prohibit even verbal agreements between teams and coaches, so anything that's out there is speculation. It might happen. Who knows? And I'm not doubting the good reports and reporters that are making those reports. But obviously nothing is official, and we'll see what happens once the Vikings, or if the Vikings, are eliminated from the playoffs. Who knows? They could be playing for 2.5 more weeks still if they get all the way to the Super Bowl. So that's where I will start. And, Paul, we haven't talked a whole lot about Shurmur. We did a little bit last week. I had a lot of interesting numbers on his 10 years yesterday that I won't get back into today with the Rams and the Browns. And my basic theme was, based on the talent he had in St. Louis and Cleveland, I don't think you can judge a lot from the success of the offenses in those years because they didn't have a lot of success. But this year in Minnesota, I think there's a lot of positive signs, not just in the results, but in how he's gotten those results.
Yeah, I think the hardest part about that type of evaluation, John, it's not just necessarily the guys who are on the roster under his command, but also, we don't know necessarily in all the different places he was at what the head coach's mandate was. And that sometimes can affect what you see on the field as a coordinator.
Well, remember, too, his second year in Cleveland, new ownership came in. And obviously when new ownership comes in, they want to put their whole new stamp on the franchise.
So it's hard for me to make concrete judgments about coordinators in that there are so many things. I'll give you a great example. I had somebody tweet me about the Vikings' play selection in the last couple minutes of that game the other day and how they wound up giving Breeze time to come down and get the go-ahead field goal. And they were...
So you're talking about the defensive play selection, not offensive?
Yes, yes, okay, yes, yes. And my response was, well, and they were also critical of the pass plays on the Vikings series beforehand, saying that both of the play selections were not very good by the coordinators.
Okay.
To which I responded, okay, now, do you know for a fact that that's what they were either doing on their own, or do you know for a fact if the head coach was checking off on the plays and changing them?
And at the end of games in those critical situations, the head coach will throw his two cents.
Absolutely he will.
Yes.
Do you know if, for example, I think it was on the next-to-last series where the Vikings wound up throwing the ball some and again, allowing some too much time on the clock. Do you know that maybe Keenum didn't audible out of a run to a pass? How do you know that? So it's hard for me to make concrete decisions on coordinators based on what I've seen on the field. I can make some generalities. That I can do. You know, you can certainly see certain things, trends over the course of time. But if you're going to pick out particular plays or particular game, I think that's really unfair to do because there are too many variables that may have changed what you've seen.
Here are the things we do know. We know he's been in the league for a very long time. He was part of an extremely successful program in Philadelphia for the better part of a decade with Andy Reid when they dominated the NFC East. Like, really, no team has dominated the NFC East probably since – you know, Cowboys early 90s and then the Giants in the 80s. Yeah. So the Giants and the Redskins kind of shared some of that time in the 80s together. So he has that on his ledger. He's been around the league for a long time. He's been a coordinator for a long time. He's been a head coach once before. So you put all those things together, he seems to have the tools and experience necessary to potentially be successful in a second go-around as head coach. Of course, you never know if the guy's in the building. You see the players he has, how he meshes with them, how he is in front of a team, how he leads an organization. That's something you can't really see until he's in your building and you take a look at him and how he does his job.
That's very true. You know, I think the one thing about all of the candidates that the Giants looked at, whether or not they had had previous head coaching experience or not, at least these were guys who had been in the league for a while. You know, it wasn't like they were looking at any newbies. these guys have all done some significant things somewhere along the line that had given them credibility. And that's what the Giants were looking for. They were looking for someone who was going to be credible. Again, no superstars in the bunch, but guys who had legitimate, credible resumes. And I will say this, John. Pat Shurmur, to me, the one thing about him, and I know a lot of people don't necessarily think much of this, but his uncle was an absolute football genius.
Fritz Shurmur.
Yes. Defensive genius. One of the true great defensive coordinators of the last 30 years in the National Football League. And, you know, I know it's not like osmosis, like just because you're related to the guy, automatically you're smart. But one thing I will say about Pat Shurmur, you know he was brought up in a football family with the ability to glean a lot of stuff right from the crib, okay, if you will, because I'm sure Uncle Fritz, you know, went to nephew Pat and gave him a lot of spoon-fed football over the years. So this guy is a football lifer. And that's, you know, I do tend to lean toward those guys, you know, and give them the benefit of the doubt in a lot of ways because, you know, they were gleaned in football. So I really like that about them. I'm looking forward, to be honest, I'm looking forward to hearing a bunch of Fritz Shurmur stories when Pat gets here.
Absolutely. And by the way, you talk about family tree. Pat Shurmur's son, Kyle Shurmur,
is currently a player at Vanderbilt.
And Ryan Dunleavy, who's new to the Giants beat from NJ.com, he replaces James Cratch. He had a good story up there today talking about.
Did he?
Yes, talking about Kyle Shurmur out of Vanderbilt.
He's got another year to go.
He does, yeah. He's going back to school for a senior year. He set a bunch of different records there at Vanderbilt, who obviously has tough sledding in their conference with a lot of good teams in there with them.
Yeah.
So that Shurmur stuff, we could obviously take calls on that. Other offseason Giants stuff. Paul, Lance and I didn't have a chance to talk about the games over the weekend, so I'm going to do that really, really fast.
Okay.
Obviously, the Patriot-Titan game I'll kind of push aside because that was a bit one-sided.
What a surprise.
The one thing I want to make one quick point about each game. The point I want to make about the Jaguar-Steeler game is that the only reason the Steelers were even in that game was because they have so much talent on the offensive side of the ball between their quarterback making the throw, their wide receiver or running back in Le'Veon Bell's case making great catches. That's the only reason they were even in the game against Jacksonville. People say, oh, Jacksonville's defense, look at all the points they gave up. Do you know how many spectacular plays the Steelers had to make to stay in that game? But boy, that Jacksonville pass rush is tough, and I guarantee you that Tom Brady is thinking, another Tom Coughlin-built pass rush is going to be coming after me. Oh, boy, I'm not happy about that. And by the way, give Doug Marrone credit, too, because he did a real good job.
Oh, sure, sure. Can we throw out a bouquet to Pat Flaherty, the offensive line coach of the Jaguars?
Sure. I don't think they ran the ball spectacularly in that game.
Yeah, but he has instilled a toughness in an offensive line that, unlike the Vikings, which has been really overhauled in the last year, the Jaguars' offensive line, those are a lot of the same guys.
Paul, here's the beauty of it. And we talked about it this year when we talked about Fluker's effectiveness and whether or not he could be a long-term answer. How you play can really help your offensive line.
No question.
And how the Jaguars play helps that unit a lot. They just don't have a lot of 5-7 drop step quarterback drops where they're asked to protect for that long because of the way the Jaguars play. And that's a credit to the coaching staff for playing in a way that allows them to succeed with the talent on the roster and the coaching done with those guys too.
Yes, and you know, I know I'm going a little off topic, but I thought the same thing happened with the Eagles after Wentz got hurt. They adapted their offense to an offensive system and a scheme and play calling that was going to allow Foles to succeed. They absolutely tailored their offense to him.
And by the way,
great job by Doug Peterson.
What do you think the Vikings did this year with Case Keenum and their offensive line?
I mean,
the Vikings don't have a great offensive line, but they play in the system well enough to get the job done.
You asked me before the show about what are some of the things we've learned from these playoff teams and what are some of the similarities? Well, what you just said right there is a great point to make because no one is more of a chameleon with what they do on the field than what Bill Belichick does with the Patriots. He can beat you differently every single week.
On both sides of the ball.
On both sides of the ball.
Correct.
Okay? Well, these two teams, or these three other teams in the playoffs right now, have all been chameleon-like on offense in that they've been able to change and mold what they are doing with quarterbacks who are not considered superstar players.
And the Jaguars made that adjustment in the offseason. The
yes.
Eagles had to make it in the offseason to Wentz. They put a lot of that run-pass option stuff.
And then
they
had to go back.
Do it again
yes.
with Nick Foles. And then,
Vikings
of course,
went through three quarterbacks.
The Vikings went through three quarterbacks. Exactly.
You know?
So,
and even the Jaguars, because of Fournette not being available
yep.
to carry the ball 22 times a game.
Not to mention their best wide receiver getting hurt, like Allen Robinson, earlier in the year.
So they've had to do some yes. chameleon-like things in season two.
I think that's a good point.
So that's you know, in a roundabout way, John, before we get on the air, you really brought up a great linchpin for what's going on right now.
All right, that's the AFC. The NFC, I think it's going to be a fun NFC championship game. It's not going to be the prettiest football in the world, I don't think. I think you're going to see the quarterbacks on the ground an awful lot with these two pass rushes. And to me, and I know this is a cliche and you want to call it a cop-out, that's fine. I'll have my predictions with Feagles on Friday for you, Paul. But whichever quarterback and offense doesn't make the big mistake, because you saw Case Keenum
yeah.
throw one of the worst interceptions you'll ever see in a playoff game against the Saints when
wow.
he just threw that thing up
wow.
near the sideline. That was a disaster. And the way the Eagles used Nick Foles, they kept him in that run pass option, short pass decision thing. But look, the Vikings defense is too good. They're not going to let the Eagles just do that to them. They're going to come out with a game plan to stop those, and then we'll see what Nick Foles can do.
You know what's really more scary about Nick Foles than the Nick Foles of the past? He is a game manager. Let's not kid ourselves. But they can take their shots downfield because they've got skill positions who can make those plays.
But here's the thing.
That's the difference.
And Chris Carlin has made this point on FAN, and he was down in Philadelphia, so he has a front
yes.
row seat to this. Before the year, Nick Foles did not play in the preseason because of a bad arm.
Right.
And he doesn't think Nick Foles' arm is all the way back. And quite frankly, watching him, I'm not sure if it is either.
I don't think he's ever had a great arm to begin with.
That's the point. Throw that on top of the injury, and I'm not sure if he can get the ball down the field.
Anyway. Yeah, but you know what? Their offensive line does a real nice job. They're skill position guys. And
they have four running backs that they can get the ball to, too, by the way.
You know what? I'm going to go back a couple minutes. Remember what we said about the common thread about these teams, the chameleon-like offenses? I'm going to give you one more common thread, John.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, it's so apparent, so apparent. Time after time after time, the winning teams in these games have made the plays for their quarterbacks on the other side of the ball. They have played above the X's and the O's. They have made the spectacular catch. They have made the difficult catch when, time and time again, as many unnamed teams during the course of the regular season proved to us,
dropsies.
They could not even make the simple plays.
Correct.
Never mind the terrific play. I tweeted out the other day, Antonio Brown made two sensational touchdown catches over the weekend.
Dude, how about the Le'Veon Bell catch when the guy had his hand on the ball? And
Le'Veon Bell also. And made them look routine.
He did.
Now, Ben put the ball exactly where it had to be, but they finished the plays for him. You know, folks, so much of us want to just dump on quarterbacks left and right every time that a team winds up with 10 points, team winds up with 13 points. Oh, they haven't scored 30 points in 3 years or whatever it is that they want to say. Okay, well, guess what?
2 seasons.
When you know what I'm saying.
I do, yes.
When your skill position guys don't make plays for that quarterback.
I know.
And doesn't it just tick you off to see how there's a handful of these teams that are still playing, they make the plays for their quarterback?
Final point I want to make.
Anyway.
As soon as the play at the end of that Vikings-Saint game happened,
yes,
I just said, oh, man, Marcus Williams, what the heck were you doing? The drops his head. He doesn't look at the tackle. It goes back to fundamentals.
Mm-hmm.
But putting that aside, because that's been talked about a million times already, I hope he's able to overcome that because he's a good player.
He is a good player.
He's made first-team All-Rookie. He played a lot of games. The Saints have a lot of good young players in their defense, and a play like that can really haunt the guy. Like, how much have we heard from Raheem Moore after that big play? They ended up blowing in the Super Bowl AFC Championship game. I don't remember. I think it was AFC Championship
yeah.
game. I hope he's able to bounce back from that, and he has a and he doesn't let this thing bother him and tarnish what could be an excellent career.
There's no question he took the wrong philosophical approach on the play, and it was a poor decision, and he paid for it.
He dipped his head.
But how about the fact that they only I don't want to get too deep into this because it's not a Giants game, and I know that's not what we do here.
No, go ahead.
But how about rushing three guys and sending everybody back, not just in a dime package, but how about a quarter package?
It was quarters coverage.
I mean, how about really sending guys back in an umbrella defense, 35 yards off the line of scrimmage?
Well, the problem is that
they rushed four, John.
Yeah, but they had to stop him from getting into field goal range. That's why. Because even if he catches the ball and gets out of bounds, they indoors, you can kick a 50-yard field goal.
Time was of the essence, though.
It was tight, but that's why you couldn't do the full prevent umbrella
But you didn't have to rush four. You could easily have still played half of a prevent by rushing three.
But some people would argue if you rush four, you have a better chance of getting to the quarterback and preventing that type of long pass to begin with.
In that situation, I'd rather have the extra guy in the back.
To me,
I'd rather have eight back than seven.
See, I hear you, and it's a good point. I think it's a fair argument. But I can't get too mad at the defense when it was designed perfectly to have your player in the right position to make the play, keep the guy in bounds, and end the game. The guy was there.
And that's
he was there.
That's also fair. That's also fair.
I mean, the coach can't say, well, what if this guy completely misses? I should have somebody else there. You don't design plays that way. You know what I mean?
We've talked about this in the past, folks, and I know Marvin, our coach up there in New England, is so good about getting back to us on these points. This is where the corner wants to play the man instead of the ball. And that's where he screwed up, because he wanted to perfectly time his hit to jar the ball loose. That's what he tried to do. When he went down low, he was going to try to hit him at the moment of impact of the ball to knock the ball free.
And it's funny, I looked at the coach's tape too, Paul. He was in perfect line with
the guy
until about 2 yards when he sidestepped for some reason and missed him.
Let him catch the ball. Play the man. Catch the ball, wrap him up, game over.
Yeah.
He went for the kill hit that was going to jar the ball free.
And that's situational awareness, too.
And I don't know what he was told, because I didn't talk to anybody after the game. I was not in the locker room. But if I'm the secondary coach, if I'm the defensive coordinator, if I'm the head coach, at some point during those last plays, when that defense goes out onto the field, Sean Payton and company, you got to tell your defensive backs, guys, just wrap up. Break down and wrap up. Under no circumstances are you going for the ball-jarring hit. This is not about defending the pass. This is about defending the player. That's where I think they made the mistake.
201-939-4513. Pardon me. I promised Joe in Pennsylvania we get to him first today, and I keep my promises. So let's go to Joe first. Joe, what's up, man? How are you?
Hey, great there. What you're talking about, I'll tell you what influenced that game. You don't want to hear it, but it was the refs. Oh. If you remember in the game early, there was some big penalties, defensive penalties called against their backs that set up scores for the Vikings there. It took, you know.
Bad calls happen in every game, Joe. You got to overcome them. That's just the way it goes.
There. And you know what they did? What's his name called? Their coach called the timeout that last play in the game. He says, whatever you do, because they was worried, don't rough them. So he was worried about hitting high and roughing them. That ref had them all messed up just by touching them.
The guy was 4 feet in the air. Unless the guy literally has a jetpack up his rear end, he couldn't have committed helmet-to-helmet contact. The guy was too high.
That's why he was going low, too. Belichick said, Belichick, but Payton said, whatever you do, don't rough him. Don't hit him early. And believe me, they were in their heads. There were very questionable calls, them ones early.
Well, Joe, you know what? If the Saints rather really let the referees get in their heads and that's why they missed the play, that's the Saints' fault. It's not the refs' fault.
I agree.
Well, that one cornerback was there too, man. Whatever. Well, I want to move on to Mr. Shermer there.
Shermer.
No, I do like him, you know. And I mean, it does show he was You know what I mean? He does go West Coast, but he's been in a variety of that, and he really does go play action a lot with Nick Foles and that. I see a lot of his games, and the way I'm hearing, maybe he's going to bring that quarterback's coach over from the Eagles to be the offensive coordinator. I forget what his name is.
Well, as my understanding is that John DeFilippo is still under consideration for a head coaching job in Arizona. So I wouldn't, you know, I think we got to wait for that to resolve itself first.
Well, I that's what I heard, you know what I mean? Anyway, whatever. And I guess the other big one, you know, there is a big close ties with Spags, and I just don't know if that's good for the team or not. I like Spags, but I just don't know there. And I just think we should draft, you know what I mean, with him and that there, that, you know, that Rosen is a big play-action guy there. He ran that system and that, and I really think that they're going to heavily look at him and possibly bring him in there. So, and the only other thing is, I you know, I love that Barkley, but hold off on him from Penn State because the draft is loaded with running backs.
It is.
And we can pick them up. So I really love that Michelle there from Alabama. So that's all. No, it's going to be a great game to watch. Did the Vikings ever win a Super Bowl?
Nope.
Nope, and neither do the Eagles. And, I mean,
nope.
It's two great defenses.
Neither of the Jaguars.
You know, but I mean, the Vikings and the Eagles, two great defenses, you know, two backup quarterbacks. And we're going to watch Sherman, how he's going to operate on the Eagles. And he knows Foles really good, too. So that's all I have to say. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate the call.
Okay.
I don't like getting too much into the refs. That's just not my thing. Bad calls are bad calls. The one thing I will say is that if you're going to use New York to make the decisions on a lot of these calls,
right?
Why do we have to go through the process of the guy going over to the screen and sitting there? By the way, he's not just there for 30 seconds. He's there for like 4 minutes. When you know New York has already seen the definitive replay to make the call on the field because we've seen it,
yeah.
Why do we have to go through the rigmarole of the guy on the field watching the damn thing? If New York's going to do it, let New York do it. And that would shave minutes of these reviews off. That part is confusing to me. I feel like it's taken longer to do these since it's gone back to New York, when in reality it should take less time.
I suspect, and without having someone from the league on to talk about this, I suspect they want to have enough conversation and give and take with the chief referee to say, all right, look, what did you see or what did your guy see? Because we have a visual on the screen, but we want to know, in addition to what's on the screen, what did you see on the field, and how can we interpret this? I do think there's a give and take there, John.
Here's my proposal. This is what I want to do, and I think this will fix a lot of the issues people have with replay. I think all mandatory reviews should be eliminated, except for the final 2 minutes of the game when it's going so fast that you have to be able to have to stop it from above because coaches won't have time to see the replay and throw the flag. So I think, except in the final 2 minutes of the game, not even the first half, the game, there should be no mandatory reviews. Not on scoring plays, not on turnovers. If something is so obvious that it's a bad call, make the coach throw the challenge flag. And you know what? If he gets the challenge right, he doesn't lose a challenge. He gets to keep it.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
I think we've had so many plays now that are getting looked at that never even would have been looked at before. Like,
yeah.
Do you really think in that Jet-Patriot game the Patriots would have challenged that Austin Seferian Jenkins touchdown that he fumbled out of bounds? I don't think they would have challenged that, but you have to look at it because it's a mandatory review.
The Steelers-Patriots game a month ago on the tight end who had the touchdown that they took away on the goal line. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody in their right mind under normal human speed would have even thought to throw a review flag on that.
That's my point. So I think a lot of people think that the game's being over-reviewed and over-officiated. I think you solve that problem by having fewer reviews. And you'll still catch the egregious ones because the coaches will throw the challenge flag on those. But some of these little minute things that people catch, we won't have as many of those, and the game will move a lot quicker. And you get the drama back. You know, every touchdown, you got to wait to see what the ref says. You can't just enjoy the touchdown
right.
for what it is.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with what you have stated.
And look, and you know me. I've always been a big proponent of review. I think instant replay is a good thing. You want to get as many calls right as possible.
And that's how I feel.
And I've always thought that way. But I feel like it's maybe gone a little bit too far, in my opinion.
The only thing I would say to that, and because I do think, especially with the slim margin of difference between these teams, yes, I do want every call that can be made corrected. So I'm kind of contradicting myself if I agree with you on this. But I also think your point about if it's so obvious, put it on the coaches. The coaches need to be the ones to make those decisions. And if the head coach and his people aren't going to gripe about that catch that was made down the sideline, well, you know, it's on them. And if the replay shows that, guess what, that touchdown shouldn't have been a touchdown, well, it's on the guy who got burned by it to say so.
And then
that's a good point.
And then Dave makes a point here, given the way the rules are now, there's a bit of a contradiction too, where only scoring plays are reviewed. Well, should they review all potential scoring plays where you think a guy got into the end zone but they didn't go on a touchdown on the field? Why should that not be automatically reviewed, but a play that got called a touchdown on the field should be automatically reviewed? There seems to be a lot of contradictions right now. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, that one is very interesting because if a guy is knocked out at like the half-yard line and they rule on the field he didn't score,
it's not reviewed.
They can't review
it. You have to throw a challenge flag on
that. So only if the official says he did go in can it be. And it's the same way. Did you know it's the same way on point afters and field goals?
Did you know that?
They can't review a field goal or a point after attempt if the officials say that it was no good. All right, let's say
you can only review field goals that were ruled to be in?
Yes.
I did not know that.
Because it's a scoring play. It's a scoring play.
Huh, that's a good point.
If the officials on the field say
if you miss the field goal, it's not a scoring play.
It's not a scoring play. Therefore, it cannot be reviewed.
That's interesting.
It's part of the rule.
You know what? I never thought of it in that context, but you're absolutely
now,
right.
Now, I've yet to see an official grant, or for that matter, a coach, throw a red flag on a field goal.
Well, there aren't that many things you can challenge.
They're pretty hard. Yes. They're pretty hard to
because
challenge.
Once it goes above the goalpost, that's not a reviewable play, and that's really where the most controversy will come up on those
right.
Of things.
I mean, you would like to believe that an official's never going to get it wrong if it goes in or outside the upright. You'd like to believe that.
You know what they should? You know how they have the pylon cam? They should have the upright cam. So cameras on the uprights,
yeah, right?
Straight up, and you could have like the lines. So then when they show the upright cam, is what I'm going to dub it. That's mine now, Fox, sorry. And it goes within or outside the lines, you know whether or not it's above or in.
I actually have an even better solution for that. Lasers inside the uprights.
Yeah, you could do that too. You could do that too. The problem is that what the wind blows and the lasers get off kilter.
Well, they do it in tennis.
I know, that's true. They do. That's a good point. All right, 201-939-4513. Carl in Syracuse is up next. Hi, Carl. How are you?
Hey, how you doing?
We're great, Carl. What's up?
Hey, John, I heard you and Lance talking the other day about a third-round pick under Dave Gettleman with the Panthers.
Trey.
And how he ended up being an all-pro.
Pro bowler. Trey Turner made a pro bowl. The guard.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Could that possibly mean the end of the drought of the third-round pick for the Giants? I mean,
you would hope.
Thompson, yeah, he had an injury, but I mean, he still hasn't proven anything yet. So next year, maybe he could determine that differently. But if we end up going a quarterback, number two overall this year, then Davis Webb, his future could be in question. So that's another third-round pick.
Hey, Carl, here's the thing. And if you go back and you look at where the failures have been over the last 10 years or let's say 6 or 7 years in terms of player acquisition, you know, Giants have had a number of first-round picks that have worked out. They've had some that haven't. They've had a bunch of second-round picks that have actually probably been their most consistent round, picking in the second round.
Right.
But where they've had the dearth of talent coming in is in the third, fourth, and fifth rounds, and they simply have not developed enough starters out of those rounds since, you know, 2009, 2010.
That goes back to something you asked me before the show started, John, about ceilings and floors. Well, guess what? There have been some real low floors for the middle rounds.
And some high – they might think there's a high ceiling, Marvin Austin, but the floor was very, very low, and sometimes it doesn't work out.
Say DeMondre Moore.
Oh, yeah, or that too, yeah.
That's what happens. That's what happens. Yeah, you got to make sure when you get to that later stages of the draft, you need guys that aren't going to be necessarily be hit or miss guys. You need guys that are going to be able to produce
solid
something.
Starters. Just get a guy that you think is going to be able to start, even if he's a situational starter, a guy that can start.
Get a guy who can play.
And do you think that's part of the reason why Dave Gettleman made that change and is going to do the draft himself this year so that we can head in a new direction, start over?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure. I think it's more that's probably why John Mara made the change, and Dave Gettleman is obviously part of that.
Yeah, and I don't want to get into Dave's head as to why he's setting this up the way it is, but he's a hands-on guy. And trust me,
right. He's
a workaholic and a tapeaholic.
That's his happy place.
Yeah, it really is. So, you know, you can have all the faith and confidence in the world in Dave Gettleman because he is going to take his hands and go deep into the mud here and dig for these guys. He's not goofing around. I'll tell you that.
Right, and given that it's year one, I'm thinking that maybe he just wants to get his hands in there and get the ball rolling.
Well, hey, the Giants' mandate, John Mara said, I expect us to be a good team in 2018. The mandate is get this thing turned around as quickly as possible. There's no waiting around for this now. This is not about patience.
Right.
Thank you, Carl.
Thank you.
Dave, why'd you have to go and put all the third-round draft picks on the screen? You're making me sick.
No, we're not reading those names. We're not doing it.
You're making me sick,
we're not doing
Dave.
It. It's been a really, really – you know, how about this? Would it be fair if I said that's been the Bermuda Triangle of the Giants draft? Is that a fair statement? No? You don't think so?
I'm trying to figure out a nice way to put it.
It's a Bermuda Triangle.
Since Justin Tuck, it's not been a source of value.
The gentleman who has produced the most on that list outside of Tuck is Mario Manningham.
Yeah.
Who, of course, had a phenomenal postseason in 2011. And Without him, they don't win it.
And that's a guy that, look, he didn't turn out to be a star. He didn't turn out to even be a starter. But he turned out to be a good, solid, situational player, which is fine. If you get that, it's fine. That's okay. And Darian Thompson is the other guy who is probably, honestly.
Jury out.
You want to laugh?
Jury out.
Darian Thompson's played basically 1 year with the Giants. If you take 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. The 8 previous players on this list.
He's done more than all of them combined.
He's probably had more snaps.
In terms of production.
Or production.
Yeah.
Or starts than all those other players combined.
And you know what?
Wow.
I don't want to totally slight Jay Alford because he did have that hit on Brady at the end of the Super Bowl in Arizona.
That's true.
It was a big play. So,
and some of those guys had
injuries,
too.
Do thank him
too,
for that one.
And some of those guys, like Jay Alford had a knee. He never was able to get back from that.
Bunch of them were hurt. There's no question.
The safety from LSU who was the pitcher, he obviously got into the car accident.
Chad Jones,
yeah. That's just bad luck. What are you going to do? So
Jairus Wilkinson concussed, and he's out of the league.
So, yeah.
I mean.
It happens.
All right.
Matt in Rhode Island, he's up next. Hi, Matt.
I almost hung up thinking listening to those third-round
picks.
Hey,
I did not list them, Matt. You're welcome. You're welcome.
this is not why I'm calling, but just so you guys know, Todd Haley was fired today as the offensive coordinator of the Steelers.
I saw that.
Something to keep in mind. I don't know if he has any relation with Shermer for the possible coordinator job, but I actually agree with Paul. He said something earlier in the show about, you know, it's kind of hard to tell with a coordinator what kind of head coach they're going to be.
Yeah, it's very hard.
It's because you don't know how much influence the head coach
Correct.
Has, if he's reining him in. You saw with McAdoo, he did a nice job as a coordinator here, kind of getting the Giants back on track, and things fell off.
Well, Matt, for example, and I'll throw this out there real quick, and I said this on the show yesterday, what the hell am I supposed to take out of Shermer's time as offensive coordinator for the Eagles under Chip
Correct.
Kelly?
Correct.
How am I supposed to do that?
Correct.
It's not his system. It's Kelly's offense.
Make them stink?
I don't know.
Think it's probably them stinking, but right, yeah. There's so many factors that go into it, and especially he's a head coach now. You're not an offensive coach. You're a head coach now.
Yep.
So there's just so many things here. I'm on board. You know, I'm willing to give anybody a shot. You know, I'm not an expert on the coaches around the league. My biggest concern, I think, it should be everybody's, is this team right now. On paper, has zero starting offensive caliber linemen under contract. And if they're going to take a quarterback with that second pick, and I'm going to kind of hang up and listen, how can this team build a competent offensive line going into next year? Thanks for taking my call.
I appreciate it, Matt. Look, theoretically, let's say you use that first pick. Let's say you, just in theory, Paul, you don't trade down and you use that first pick on a non-offensive lineman.
I think
player.
Before you go there, sure. you want to gauge who is, in fact, going to be coming back. Is Pugh coming back? We know Jerry's under contract.
Correct.
We know Brett Jones is under contract.
Brett Jones is actually technically not under contract.
Well, he's not, but he's tied up.
He's restricted.
Yes, he's correct. Restricted. He's basically tied up.
The
he's
only
not going anywhere.
Flowers is back, obviously.
Flowers we know is back.
Flowers, Jerry, and Brett Jones are the three guys that played significant time that more than likely than not will be back next
year.
And
I brought up Jerry first because last week when we were talking about this, I think with Lance, just forgot Jerry out of the conversation. I did not mean to be disrespectful to him. And I would really strongly advocate re-signing Fluker, but
really,
you know, oh yeah, absolutely, I would.
You want to bring Fluker back?
He's being funny, folks. But having said that, he is not under contract right now, just like Richburg and Pugh are not.
Correct.
So you have to decide first of all what is it you know you have and what you think you can bring back from that group before you even talk about the draft.
Right.
Honestly.
But, no, absolutely right. And free agency is important. You got to look at it. But even if you don't pick an offensive lineman in the first round, you have the second pick in the second round. You might be able to get the second best interior offensive lineman in the whole draft with that pick. Quentin Nelson's not going to be there now.
No.
But you might not have another guard or center go in that first round. And by the way, you might be able to get a top three or top four interior lineman in the draft with the first pick in the third round, if you pick the right guy.
Yeah. And tackle's more important, though, than the interior lineman.
I agree. I'm just throwing it in terms of, look, if you don't bring back Justin Pugh or Weston Richburg, guess what? You better get a guard.
Yeah. I have only done very preliminary. I have not done any tape work, but I have done some preliminary conversations with people, and they tell me that there are four rounds of make-it offensive linemen in this draft.
And I think three, from what I've seen, think three first-round offensive tackles. You have the McGlinchey kid from Notre Dame,
mm-hmm.
the Connor Williams kid, and then Orlando Brown's kid.
Zeus Jr.
Yes.
Yep.
So those are the three first-round tackles.
For sure. For sure.
Two of those maybe top 15, one for sure top 15. And then
– well, McGlinchey for sure.
See, most people I read have Connor Williams ahead of him. Mm-hmm. But, of course, he's coming off the knee, too. So the combine for him and the med checks will be very, very important. Again, it's way too early, guys, to start ranking these guys. That's something I'm
Here's what I will say, though. It does appear that this offensive line crop, even though we always talk about how offensive linemen are not built for the pros coming out of college.
It's a little bit better.
It does appear it's better than last year's.
It's a little bit better. And even 2 years ago.
We were mortified when we went to the combine last year. Yeah. It's like, are you kidding me?
And you know what the shame of it is? If Ryan Ramczyk didn't get hurt, if he wasn't dealing with that injury, he easily could have been the Giants pick.
Remember when I brought him up last December? Right. December of 2016, Ramczyk.
We said it last year. He checked all the boxes except for that hip injury.
And, you know, turned out he has rehabbed and he's done well for the Saints. But, again, the offensive line depth is definitely better in this year's draft than it was last year. That's good news for the Giants.
We don't have Matt still on the line, do we? Matt, did we just talk over you? No? Okay, let's go to Pete in Staten Island. He's up next. Hi, Pete.
How you doing, guys?
Hi.
Paulie, I want to pretty much confirm, you know, you had talked about something with a tweet earlier about Pat Shermer's play call in there towards the end of the game, which left Drew time.
I was talking about it. I didn't tweet it. I was just talking about it.
Yeah, and I will, you know, I'll give you some insight on that because I was sitting with a friend who's a big Minnesota Viking fan, and he was pulling his hair out, and literally with the play calling. They had first and 10 on the 39-yard line with about a minute and change to go, and he threw three consecutive passes, okay?
Be careful.
Only had one timeout left.
Right.
Okay? And they had questioned, and he's pulling his hair out, and I'm telling him, I agree with you. I don't know what the hell he's doing. He should be running clock. And after the game, they had questioned Shermer on it, and his answer to the question, and my friend had the feed up, His answer to the question was that he thought it was time to wing it, and he was not going to be conservative.
Did he say wing it?
He thought it was time to wing it, yes.
Wing or
and
win?
Wing it, like throw it.
Oh, okay.
W-I-N-G.
Got it, okay.
Okay.
And he didn't want to be conservative, even though he was cognizant of the time. And I was thinking, and I'm a Giant fan, and I'm thinking along the lines, oh, my God, I don't want to wing it with that. I don't want to leave Drew Brees a minute and change to go,
well, Pete,
you know, go down the field.
Well, Pete, here's the
goal.
Thing. I want to bring something up here for a second, and then, Paul, you can go too. At that point, the Vikings are down 1 point, 21-20. They don't even have the lead yet. They have it first and 10 on the 40-yard line. You want to – I mean, ideally, you want to get – at least 8 to 12 more yards before you kick a field goal. So if you come out – and look, I'm not sure what personnel the Saints had on the field. They had heavy personnel expecting
we'd
the
have
run.
To go back
I would have to, look at it. Yeah, that's
I
the thing.
No
but
idea.
That's the thing. You have to call the play. Pete, no, Pete, hold on. Pete, hold on. Pete, here's
the first play.
Right, that's
go
the
ahead.
Thing. You have to run the plays that you think have the best chance of getting you yards. Your top priority there is getting into better field goal range and not running the clock. That's my point.
I agree.
What's his name? Troy Aikman had said that Mike Zimmer felt that he was comfortable, his kicker was comfortable being good at the 35-yard line, okay? So on that first down play, they got down to the 36, all right? Now he threw it on the second down play. It was incomplete. Then he threw it again on the third down, and that shocked me. That totally shocked
me. Well, yeah, Pete, you had the order a little bit wrong. On first and 10, he threw an incomplete pass. Then it was second and 10 on the 40. Then he threw the pass for 5 yards, like you said.
Okay.
So it was third and 5 at the 35. On that, you're third and 5 at the 35, you're trying to get the first down there. Because if you get the first down, guess what? Drew Brees might not even touch the ball again at all if you get the first down. So honestly, I don't have a huge problem with that.
If there's a holding call or something like that, it takes you out of field goal range. I mean, that's a dangerous game you're playing.
I think it's a debatable point, but I think that there are multiple sides to that prism. Certainly what John says has weight.
And you can have a holding call and a run play, too.
No question. What you're saying, I get it. I get it. Here's what we don't know, okay? And I get what you're saying. I'm going to take your word for it that that's what Shermer said after the game. I didn't see it. But.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would wing it,
Zimmer,
by the way.
Zimmer also could have told him, let's go for it. He could have told him on that set of downs, let's go for it. And Shermer's saying, okay, we're going to wing it. I mean, it could have come.
I'm a big Sherman, Mike Zimmer fan.
So,
I really am.
So am I.
I want to make this clear.
And you know what? As far as Mr. Shermer goes, I watched a lot of his games this year. I play fantasy football, and I have Adam Thielen on my team.
He's
so
really
I watch them a lot. And he is not like I am. I'm not a West Coast kind of rooter as far as a coach. I like the Northeastern type of football like you do, Paul, with the smash mouth kind of thing.
Yeah.
And the directional throwing, okay, directional. He's got a combination there. He used Thielen. First off, he moved Thielen into the slot this year. He was an outsider last year. So he moved in into the slot, and he obviously had a Pro Bowl season. Then he moved it, and Dick stayed on the outside. And I watched a lot of their games. They throw the ball diagonally a lot. There's a lot of 15 to 20-yard throws to both those guys. And they use the tight end. Obviously, Rudolph's a very good tight end.
Sure.
So I think he'll do very well with Ingram and Sterling, if in fact he does get the job, of course. He'll do well with Sterling in the slot. And, of course, we know what Odell is. And as far as the running game goes, if you look, I think they had the most running plays in the entire league. I think
they were second.
They had,
They were second. They were second. They were second in rushing attempts, seventh in rushing yardage,
and they were fifth in rushing percentage. So they had the fifth highest percentage of their plays were rushing plays in the league.
Now
47%.
Again,
so
that could have
variety here. You know, it's not like he's just the West Coast.
You're right about that.
Ball for 3 yards.
And
he does throw diagonal.
That's going to be part.
Thanks, Pete. Appreciate the call.
Thank you. Right. That's going to be part of what we assume to be his characteristics. But, again, you have to repeat this. The head coach develops the framework and the philosophy of how a team is going to operate. This is why we see some coordinators have really great success, and then when they become head coaches, not so much.
And
I'm not defending or criticizing anybody. I'm simply stating different angles to look at it from the prism. That's all I'm saying.
What was the point you were going to make before?
In terms of that final series there, right, going into that Vikings field goal, you don't know what Zimmer told him, that is Shurmur, going into that final drive or even into that final possession. You also don't know what Keenum's responsibilities are and how much freedom he has there. You also don't know specifically, because we haven't looked at the tape now, we'd have to go back and look at it. I don't usually review these games. What were the Saints playing? As you said, John,
I will put this on my list of things to do.
What were the Saints playing? I mean, what is the smart play to go with, based on also what the defense is giving you or what they're showing you? There are a lot of factors that go into that. It to me, again, I'm not defending Pat Shurmur's play calling there. I'm simply saying there are multiple angles that must be looked at and considered before you make a judgment. It is blatantly unfair to simply say, you know what? He wasn't playing the clock right. He shouldn't have thrown the ball at all. It's an unfair statement to make without examining all of the different factors.
Correct. And again, it's first and 10 at the 40. You need a field goal to win the game.
Absolutely.
Your number one priority there is not to run the clock. Your number one priority is to get yards. And I'll argue your number one priority is to still get the first down. Because if you get the first down, guess what? That game's over.
And quite frankly,
it's over.
Quite frankly, even if you're looking to get more points, the ball's at the 36 on the third down call.
35. It's third and five at the 35 yard line.
That's a 52 yard field goal.
53.
Okay. It's not a gimme.
And I know he feels comfortable from that range. That doesn't mean.
I get it.
That doesn't
not
mean
a gimme.
Doesn't mean you'd not rather have it to be a 42 yard field goal.
Not a gimme.
No.
That's all I'm saying.
It's a tough kick. And I want to say one other thing. I thought. Yeah, go ahead, Paul. I'm sorry.
Well, and the final point is, you also have to gauge, he has to gauge, with all these other factors that are going into it, and this is why I love football so much. It's a spider web. It's a domino effect game. Everything is so tied together. The other thing you also must feel is, what is the feel that he's got for his team and what they're doing at that particular moment in time?
Right.
If he really feels, you know what, I like the way our front is handling their front, mm-hmm. and I feel really good about the percentages of being able to throw a short pass or a long pass because we are totally neutralizing their front and they really can't do anything to us right now, mm-hmm. that's going to affect his decision, John.
Yeah, I think the one question you could have, 1:47 to go, first and 10 at the 40, maybe run it on first down to try to make him use the one timeout.
Sure.
But then on second and 10, I have no problem passing the football when you're at the 40-yard line. No problem at all. And then on third and five, I'm trying to get the first down there. I'm not just trying to run a clock.
Yeah.
I'm going for the first down. One other thing Pete did say that was absolutely right. I know I've talked about him being a West Coast guy, and absolutely true he is. But I took a look at probably six Vikings games yesterday trying to find staples, and you'll see trying to find staples of that offense and what they do. Mostly a zone running scheme, which is consistent with West Coast principles. They mm-hmm. generally use the zone principles. And again, most of the league that even doesn't use West Coast principles uses zone blocking schemes.
There's a lot of it going on.
It isn't just West Coast. So that's number one. Number two, ton of play action passes. Mm-hmm. And that obviously is using a lot of different styles. And you will see play action pass guys going down the field, which is also not necessarily West Coast principles. So I think he's kind of taken a little bit from his time with Chip Kelly. And he's also carried over a lot of the stuff that North Turner did there last year before he took over for a midseason as the play caller. And Mike Zimmer has never been a West Coast offense type of coach. I know he's a defensive coach, but he's never been a West Coast offense guy. I'm sure he's wanted some of that stuff left in. So I agree. even though you still see a lot of core West Coast offense plays, for example, that long Stephon Diggs crossing route he caught, there were three picks in that play, which is a staple of the West Coast. I'm sorry,
yes.
Rub routes.
Yes.
That's a
yes.
staple of the
yes.
West Coast offense. So that stuff's still there, but he'll run power in terms of putting extra offensive linemen in. Their fullback played over 200 snaps this year. So they will use a fullback even more than the Giants used or combined the last 2 years probably. So you do see elements of other stuff that's not pure West Coast and what he did with the Vikings.
I will say this, okay? If you're looking for a guy who's had a diverse background, I think it's fair to say Shurmur has, because not only has he run stuff under Zimmer, who we know is a Parcells disciple, okay?
Who wants to throw the ball down the field.
And play physical up front and balance and run it.
He hired Norv Turner, who runs the Air Coryell system. It's the opposite of the West Coast offense.
Okay. We know that Shurmur has also been in Chip Kelly's offense,
yep.
which does all the schematic video game funky stuff that, you know, I prefer not to use, but we know he's been in it.
College concepts, run pass options, and we saw the Vikings use run pass option stuff in that game.
So he's been exposed to both kinds of those environments.
Sure.
What you said a little while ago, John, he loves play action. Well, guess what? Eli's great at play action. Part of what Chip Kelly did was to get the most speeded up, up-tempo, hurry-up offense you could have in the NFL. Well, guess what? Eli's very good at running up-tempo stuff. He's fine with that, too. So the good news about Shurmur, you know, you want to look for, again, boxes to check. One of the boxes he checks is that he's had a variety of experiences with different styles of philosophies offensively. Even though he was based in the West Coast system originally, he has had a lot of different vegetables on his plate, and I think that's good.
Now, we'll see when he's the man in charge and making all the decisions what he ends up doing, because like you said, when you're under somebody, there's no way to know exactly what in his soul he wants to do.
We don't know.
And again, the nuggets I gave you yesterday, which I thought were good, this year 47% one run, 53% pass, which is nearly balanced, very good. Play action. This year, Case Keenum ran play action nearly 29% of his passes. He had 112 quarterback rating on those passes. That was the third highest percentage in the NFL, by the way. And in the last 4 years, Shurmur's been an offensive coordinator. His quarterbacks have been in the top 10 in adjusted completion percentage three times, which goes back to your higher percentage West Coast-style throws. That is more of the West Coast-style right there.
Stuff that Eli can run.
Yeah, absolutely. All right.
So,
two more calls, Paul. Let's get him in, okay? Jay in Brooklyn. He's up next. Hi, Jay.
Hey, guys. How you doing, man?
Hi.
I think you guys explained it perfectly as far as the coaching search went. None of these guys are slam dunks. None of them.
Right.
I mean, they all have their pros. They all have their cons.
Absolutely.
I noticed a lot of people calling about systems and West Coast and offense. My big worry, 2 points, my big worry is the locker room. Which one of these guys, I mean, you guys know, you saw that nobody was closer to it than you guys were. There were guys on that team who cut bait and ran on that team last year. And whether they want to admit it or not, which one of these guys is going to be able to get in there and command that locker room with a lot of guys, especially on defense, who have big contracts, who feel they're not going anywhere, and who are also part of the problem?
Jay, you aren't going to like my answer, because my answer is going to be I don't know. Because I can do all the tape study and watch all this stuff and do all that, but until the guy's in the building and you see him operate and how he runs a team, and look, maybe if this does happen and Shurmur does at some point become the coach, we can maybe talk to somebody that was there when he was in Cleveland and his only head coaching stint. We can get some insight into that. But as of right now, I don't know. I got to be honest with you. I don't have a great answer to your question.
Jay, I think that's one of the biggest questions of the offseason.
Jay,
besides what offense they've hit. Go ahead.
I'm going to give you a two-part answer. First part, I said it last week, and I had some people actually comment about it online to me on Twitter. None of these guys are Tom Coughlin or Dan Reeves walking onto campus commanding immediate respect just by their presence in the room. That's
correct.
Not who these guys are, okay? That's just not. The entire group of six, none of these guys are superstar, legendary head coaches that are going to command that. Tom Coughlin had enough pelts on his belt that when he walked in the room, you put the light on and you stood up at attention. Same thing with Dan Reeves.
And if you didn't, you got cut.
Okay? These guys, Pat Shurmur included, they're not that guy. So we don't know. John is right. We don't know. But the second part to my answer to you is, that's why his staff hirings are going to be triply more important, because He's not that guy who can walk into the room and shake it up. He better make sure that the staff he hires is not just good, but terrific. He's got to have staff guys, because there are many guys in this league who have had great staffs and were a success because they picked the right guys, and there have been a lot of really hit coaches in this league who didn't do so well because they didn't pick the right guys.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because that leads perfectly into my second point.
Yeah.
The fact I've noticed there's been some callers calling in. There's even been some reporters making the sentiment. I know you like the guy, Paul. I know you're a big fan of his. But the idea that there's this fascination with bringing Spagnuolo back, when he presided over all this, while all this was happening, I do not understand at all.
Because why?
Because I have no idea.
All right. I'm gonna use the same example. I'll give you the answer. It's the same example that we used in talking about Shermer as a coordinator.
Thank you, Jay. Appreciate the call, by the way. We've got to run. Buddy. We're getting close.
The problem is, it is the head coach who does set the foundation, the tempo, and the environment with the team. Steve Spagnuolo, as defensive coordinator,
he has to go along with what McAdoo's doing.
You have to. You have to. And anything that he may or may not want to do, the head coach has to have his back. He has to set the stage. He's got to set the rules. He's got to set everything. And if you don't have that necessarily the way that maybe that you wanted to do it, it's really hard to make him responsible for it.
And look, and here's the thing. They're not going to force anyone on whomever the new head coach's staff is going to be.
They will not.
He's going to pick the guy that he thinks is best. And if he believes that Steve Spagnuolo should be that guy and he should return, then by all means he should. But if at the same time he believes someone else is the best candidate, he's going to have the freedom to make that decision too. The coach gets to pick his staff with the New York Football Giants.
Yes.
It's always been that way.
I will add one more caveat. Assuming that Shermer is the guy, and again, we're not confirming that, but assuming Shermer is the guy, he is like a brother with Spags. They know each other so well that you can bet.
Well, they were in Philly forever together.
They were in Philly together. They were in St. Louis together when Spags hired him.
Yeah.
Okay? You can bet that anything that either one of those guys wants, they got each other's backs at all times because they're like brothers.
And
no knock on Coach McAdoo, but he and Spags only knew each other for a very short time. You can't tell me, and this is not being mean to anybody, that the bond between McAdoo and Spagnuolo was even anything close to the bond that Shermer and Spagnuolo have. That's just human nature.
And by the way, Coach Mack, the linebacker coach, was he in Philly for a year with
Coach
Shermer?
Coach McGovern was in Philly with Shermer for a year.
1 year, right?
Bill
That's
McGovern.
All right, final call of the show is Roldy in Bayshore. How you doing, Roldy?
What's up, guys? How you doing?
Doing great. What's up, pal? How are you?
Good. I'm at a point now. It's, you know, I know some fans, and I know Paul, you know, doesn't want to, you know, think about the rebuild mode, but I'm at a point where I just want to just start building for the future, man. I just want to do it like 2004. Get our quarterback. Let's get Josh Rosen in the first round. Get an offensive lineman in the second, like Chris Neal, like we did in 04. You know, and I know Paul was alluding to, you know, that John Mara said that.
He did.
He expects to win. But what owner doesn't expect to win going into a brand new season? You know what I mean? We got so many holes to fill. You know, we're not just going to fill every hole within 1 year. Why not just get our quarterback of the future, build, you know, for the next, you know, 10, 15 years, and hopefully, you know, we could have a caliber, you know, type team that's maybe pretending for a Super Bowl.
Paul, you can
you
go
know,
first.
Well,
I think the word that John Mara used was good. He does expect this team to be good. I think you're right. Every team says they want to win. But when an owner says we want to be good and he believes that the foundation of this roster and this locker room is still good, he doesn't want to let that window of opportunity slip away and just say, okay, we're going to throw in the towel a year or two early, rebuild this entire thing, and go from scratch. Roldy, this is what I will tell you. You can certainly argue the other side of this point. I think it's a valid opinion, but there are different sides to the prism. I will say this. You can't half-ass it no matter which way you go. If you're all in on going with this core, then you got to be all in. If you go halfway, you will fail.
See, Paul, I think, and Roldy, hold on 1 second. I'll let you finish. Don't worry. I'm going to take your side of this a little bit. I think if you're going to go all in with this core, you have to go old in. But I think you can – I don't think there's anything out there that says you can't use – again, if you believe in one of the guys – use that first-round pick on a quarterback, still bring Eli back, you still have Snacks Harrison, you still have OV, you still have JPP, you still have Jackrabbit, and you can't still try to make a playoff run this year even if you don't. Even if you use that first-round pick on a quarterback. I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. I don't.
And still try to build for the future, and that's where I'm at at this point. I appreciate what Eli Manning has done for this organization as a fan, brought me two championships. Just like in 04, Paul, you said you didn't want Eli Manning, and now you're a big advocate for Eli,
yes,
which is rightfully so. And let's say we take Josh Rosen. I promise you, 10 years from now, if he has goes on and have a great career, I promise you, you'll be sitting in the same chair saying the same thing.
Well, Ronnie, here's what I will tell you.
One more thing.
Sure.
Go ahead.
I just want to add a caveat that if Davis Webb was not here and I did not believe in Davis Webb as strongly as I do, I would not be as opposed to taking the QB.
Okay, that's a fair
point.
But Davis Webb really...
Davis...
Anyways, guys, I appreciate you guys taking
go ahead.
My phone call.
Go.
I appreciate you guys taking my phone call. I just want to give a few shout-outs. I want to send a shout-out to my Haitian people, my African people, and my El Salvador people. And also the Shakedown crew, Shakes, Black, J-Rock, E, Dan, all of y'all. I love y'all. Don't let nobody try to stand nothing you guys wrong, man.
Thank you, Roldy. All right. Good folks. We appreciate that.
Yeah, great fans. Simply put, Davis Webb has entered that equation for me, which is why I feel as I do.
That's fair.
If Rhett Bomar was the backup quarterback coming back on this team, I'd be a lot more willing to listen to taking a quarterback at number two. But we're not talking about Rhett Bomar or Ryan Perilou. We're talking about Davis Webb, who I happen to have high regard for. I can't ignore that part of the equation.
And that's fair.
So,
thank you, Paul.
Okay.
Fun show. Paul lands tomorrow. And then next week you're going to get a lot of Paul and Lance. You're going to be sick of those two guys next week because I'm
going
to be at the
Senior
Bowl. So, but I will be doing live call and hits. And I'm not sure if the show will be on during the practices or before the practices.
We don't know the schedule yet.
It's out. I don't remember what it was.
Are you going to be on the sideline or in the press box?
I think you just sit in the stands.
You sit in the stands?
I think you sit in the stands. So,
bring an umbrella.
I don't think it's supposed to rain next week in Mobile. Is it?
It rains there a lot.
But I looked at the weather. It's supposed to be in the 60s.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Johnny's a happy camper.
Whatever.
Thanks for joining us. I'm hungry. Dominic's hungrier than I am. Datino wants some pasta. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Giants.com. Have a good one, everybody. Thanks for joining us.